I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I've got 8 random questions. You give me 3 numbers, and then I ask you whatever question it correlates to. Ooh,
okay. 3.
Would you rather have to fake sneeze or fake vomit in a scene?
I'd rather vomit. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'd rather fake vomit. I feel like people always pick sneeze because it's less gross, but it's
no,
it's damn difficult to do.
I like the grossness. The fake sneeze is... Yeah. I like doing both, but I like the vomiting for some reason. It's just, there's more...
I don't know how to say this in like a not gross way, but there's just like more to do with it, you know? Like it's slimy, and I don't know, like I like thinking about like, what kind of vomit is it, you know?
I have a really gross follow-up question now. What is your favorite kind of fake vomit to do? Where like you hold oatmeal in your mouth or you get like the comical tube or?
That one, I did that in Kick-Ass 2. I had this tube that ran up and they put a half a balloon in my mouth to do the hoop before you projectile, and I literally projectile vomited on this girl's face. It was mad. I felt terrible, but it was kind of fun.
Like so many questions, but I feel like I shouldn't go down that rabbit hole. Never heard the balloon thing, and also I feel for this person.
I know, bless her.
Oh, I'll never look at that scene the same way again.
Oh, I know.
Your second number.
Mm-hmm. 7.
Another good one. This one's Scream, so it can only be one question. What's your favorite scary movie?
Oh, God. Look, I don't actually like scary things. I kind of can't watch them. I have to watch them like that, and I kind of... You know, I do like psychological thrillers.
That counts.
I liked Shutter Island.
Ooh.
Or I love Black Mirror. Mm. I like sort of something that makes you think, and it's psychological or political or something like that, and it's scary because it's kind of real. It could maybe happen.
Genre
like Fallout, maybe.
Counts.
Yeah.
What is the first scary movie you remember watching that kept you up at night?
I was invited to a sleepover when I was about 10, and they put on The Shining. And that actually might be the reason I can't watch scary movies, because I was so scared. And I know, you know, I was trying to be cool in front of my cool girlfriends. And I was like, yeah, I've watched scary movies all the time. And then I, like, cry my eyes out and had to go to bed early, which involved me not sleeping for the
it's
entire night.
It's not a movie for a 10-year-old. I always tell terrifying. Everybody, nobody ask me what's appropriate for your child because I will push movies on them way too early. But I do know that The Shining is not for
not
a 10-year-old.
Not The Shining. Stay away from The Shining.
All right, you have one more number. What is
I'll do
your
number
best?
One. I'll go back.
All right, number one is an acting question. I love this question. This is favorite, least favorite. I want to know your single favorite part of the acting process, like rehearsing, seeing a set. But then I also want to know not necessarily your least favorite, but a part of the process where you see room to grow for yourself and you're excited to tackle it.
Good questions. I would say my favorite part is... My favorite part, this is such a like pretentious actory answer, but it's when you are kind of struggling with a scene or a moment or a line and it's just not feeling right, and then you get it. And it could be like mid-take, and your inner voice goes, oh, and it all clicks and comes together, and you just find this flow, and it's kind of like that feeling of when you're a kid and you're playing like dress up or make believe, or you maybe have an imaginary friend, and you just lose yourself in that. You know, it's kind of how I imagine like musicians when they are playing and they lose themselves, and it doesn't happen as much as I would like. You know, a lot of actors, like, you know, they lose themselves all the time. I have to work really hard to lose myself.
You think that of other people. I bet you anything they struggle with the same
maybe
thing.
Maybe everyone's gatekeeping. It's actually really hard. My least favorite part is, you know, it's the feeling and the first few days and you feel crazy.
Actually, I've got two lead roles. First few days when you feel crazy and you just feel like the worst actor and you can't find it and you're like, am I doing a good job? You just feel crazy. And every actor has this where you just don't feel like you've really found your feet. You haven't found the character. And the other thing I find really hard is when you finish a job, especially a very intense job, and you have to come down. You go into this state of like fight or flight and you're just in this like hyper-adrenalized state. And I finish and, you know, I manically clean the house. That's my thing. I finish a job and I'll do a spring clean. And like, I guess I have a lot of energy that needs to go somewhere. And it's really hard to kind of regulate your nervous system again when you wrap a job.
I get that all too well. When I'm not working, I am probably cleaning. I want to follow up briefly on the other answer you just gave. And I feel like I'm jumping ahead and ruining my game with this. But do you remember the first thing you did that made you think, I have found Lucy now?
Ooh. Oh, that is a really good question. I can't remember sort of the order that we shot things, but it was, yeah, I do actually, because I remember we started with the opening sequence of episode one, which you'll see eventually. And I think the moment I found her was like during one of those little montage pieces, and there's no lines. And it was literally just like a look. And then, and it was something so, I don't want to say it because I'll give it away, but it was just a little look in the wrong time. It was sort of something that was supposed to be scary or silly. And then the look, and it was Jonah's direction that got me there, that was like kind of cheeky. And it really actually made things click for me with Lucy, that she attacks every issue with like an okie dokie attitude, you know? And it's so quaint and cute, but it's tough actually, because it's brave. Yeah.
I'll never hear okie dokie any other way but how you say it from now on.
And I say it all the time in my real life now. I've like,
I love that.
It does happen. You kind of take things from your character and then incorporate them into your real life, and it's okie dokie.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back for a brand new edition of Collider Ladies Night. This is an edition everyone's been waiting for because not only am I now obsessed with Fallout, but everybody out there knows I have a Yellow Jackets problem. Ella Purnell, congratulations on Fallout, Yellow Jackets, and everything else you've accomplished that we're going to talk about today.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry about your Yellow Jackets problem. That sounds like a terrible affliction.
Greatest affliction ever. You will get my theory. I feel like it's safe to ask you some of my theory questions, okay, or like you won't get
I'll
in trouble.
I'll see if
now.
I can help.
What is the movie you saw, performance you saw, personal experience you had, you name it, that first made you say to yourself, I absolutely have to be an actor?
You know, I had a funny introduction into acting because I was a child actor. And so my first job, I was 8 years old and I did a commercial for a candy called Toffifee, which is delicious, by the way, and everyone should have it. So I don't think I really knew I wanted to be an actor. It certainly wasn't. This is, might sound terrible, but it wasn't a dream of mine. It was more sort of like a curiosity. And I loved watching movies growing up. I watched Spy Kids and just thought they were the coolest. And actually, you know, I was talking earlier about playing games when you're a kid. And me and my best friend from childhood, we would pretend to be spies. And I was the girly girl and she was the tomboy. And we had all these gadgets, invisible gadgets, make-believe gadgets. And I think maybe that might have been inspired by Spy Kids. And I think in that moment where you lose yourself as a kid, maybe the idea started to form of like, wait, I could do this for a job. I could get paid for this and have fun doing it.
This is a classic.
Oh, Spy Kids is so good.
Will live on forever in my heart.
Me too.
So that's kind of how you got into it. When you started to work professionally, was there that moment where, I don't know, something just clicked on set and you said to yourself, like, this is going to be my career. I'm going to make it happen no matter what.
Yeah, it did. But it happened older. You know, it actually happened, I think, when I was around 18. Because between 13 and 18, I had so much going on. I was doing school and I was acting and I was learning and figuring things out and also trying to figure out who I was and big friends and all of that stuff. And I guess I never really thought of acting as a long-term career. It was always like something I did now. And also, I don't think kids are really able to think that far ahead in the future. And at least I wasn't. But I was 18 and I got Tim Burton's. And it was the first movie that I was like, I love Tim Burton. I loved all of his films growing up. I used to watch them religiously. And I was like, wow, wait, actually, I get to actually be in a Tim Burton movie. I didn't think that was even possible for someone like me. And then on set, getting to experience so many first things, and just, it was such a pinch me moment. I had no idea how this happened. And that was really like, wow, dreams actually, this is so cheesy, but dreams do actually come true. You can achieve things. Yeah.
I have so many follow-up questions. The first one will put you on the spot a little. What is your favorite Tim Burton movie?
Edward Scissorhands. It's the aesthetic. It's just like the pastel houses, and then with his gothic sort of like, every shot in that movie is just like gorgeous.
I love his filmography so much. Edward Scissorhands is up there. Beetlejuice.
Oh, just Beetlejuice.
Like, I'm obsessed with Beetlejuice.
I forgot. Oh, and the second one's coming out soon.
I'm so excited. Back to my little roadmap here to start to teeter into a couple of titles, and I will get to Miss Peregrine soon. But there's one thing about your filmography that I found really interesting that not many people out there get to experience. You started off by playing the young version of like some of our biggest acting icons, Keira Knightley, Angelina Jolie, and Margot Robbie. The answer to this question might be no, but is there anything about channeling people like them so early on in your career that, you know, maybe added new tools to your acting toolkit that you wouldn't have gained otherwise?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because with the young Margot and the young Angelina, it's not in the movie. Either it got cut or it was I was like a body double for young Margot. But the experience, everything happens for a reason. Most things happen for a reason. And I think that happened so I could learn. I mean, you're literally taking a young actor who maybe is a little directionless and aimless, and you're telling them, mimic this professional, successful, gorgeous, talented, amazing person, watch them and copy them and learn from them. And you get to do that up close. It's not a masterclass that you're watching online. You literally get to do that in real time. And like, it was not lost on me how lucky I was to be able to do that. How many people get that opportunity? So, I think everything happens for a reason. I was so young and so sort of naive, and I didn't know really what that meant, I guess, or how that would affect my life. But I do think it did.
Coolest thing ever. Big, broad question about some of your earliest titles now. Which one would you credit with giving you the most clarity in terms of like what you value most in an on-set environment?
Ooh, that's a great question. I think when I did Sweet Bitter, it was my first time doing TV. It was my first time working in America, doing an American accent, living in America. I was also like 21 and I moved to New York, and it was my first time the lead of a show, and I was in every single scene. And it really, really taught me, number one, the value of the crew. I got so close to everyone in the crew, and they still remain like some of my closest friends to date. And just how important it is to take care of each other and to advocate for each other and work as a unit, and the importance of like, yes, there's the, we're one big happy family, but also to be a functional machine that each person works together so seamlessly and efficiently to make a product. It's a miracle that anything gets made. It's so hard.
It is.
And, you know, the crew are the hardest workers. And that was definitely like such an important moment, I think.
Many follow-up questions again. I'll go with my silly one first, because you said you were 21 and all of a sudden you're shooting a show in Manhattan, like one of the biggest cities out there. Did you have like a safe haven here, a place where you would go where, I don't know, you could be put at ease or feel at home?
I was living in Williamsburg. I got really lucky, and I made these four fantastic girlfriends who were not in film and TV, and I just met them through a friend, and they became my best friends. And I met them really early on, and I didn't know anything about the city. I didn't really know anything about the States. And they introduced me to New York, and it was just like, it was really like a crazy, I felt like I found my Sex and the City crew. I was like, damn, I'm really living the dream right now. I couldn't believe it. There was no like particular place, but more just like the community and the people. And maybe that's why I got so close with the crew as well, is because I didn't know anyone and I was in the city and it was new for me, kind of like my character, I guess. And they really do become your family.
That's such a wonderful, wholesome answer. My answer to that question at 21 moving here was basically living at a place called the Peanut Butter Company.
What is a peanut butter company?
It's literally a sandwich shop that only makes peanut butter sandwiches. But I'm like, whenever I didn't have someone to hang out with, I would just go there and
wait. That's amazing.
They sell it in supermarkets still, like the, you know, jars of it.
I gotta try this.
I highly recommend it. It's very good peanut butter.
Great rec. I will take you up on it.
Here's like a big shift, because the other follow-up question that I thought of was like a very heavy one. Do you remember the very first time you felt the power of your own voice on a set, where you could speak up, someone would listen, and something on set would change for the better?
Yeah, there's a few occasions like that. There have definitely been a few times, you know, there's been a few times, you know, that they're sort of like personal memories and personal anecdotes. There's been a few times where mental health has to be prioritized. There's been times where the safety on set has to be prioritized. There's been times where I've worked with weapons for the first time. You know, I live in England. The gun culture is not something I'm familiar with. And I've had to really advocate just for myself to understand, how does a gun work? Is this safe? You know, can I just ask questions? Because I don't really know. But I think actually it was probably when I was a little younger, maybe around 15, 16. And, you know, I have an incredible team. I've been with my US and my UK agents for years and years and years. But realizing, like, you know, I don't want to do those. I don't want to do nudity, or I don't want to do a love story, or I don't want to do this. And actually being a little bit embarrassed the first time you ask those things, because you feel like, is this going to, am I less of an actor? Am I less professional? Am I less this? And having them really validate my feelings, and like, no, it's okay to have preferences. It's okay to not feel comfortable doing this, doing that. You know, my first kiss was on screen in a movie. And I think that was, that took me a couple of years to reckon with that. And then to actually be able to be like, no, I think I need to take a break. I want to do comedy. I want to do action. And then have someone actually value that opinion and that preference is really, really empowering and important for a child actor to have that validation, I think.
I'm so happy that you had a team like that at your back. I feel like one of the things that's most difficult to learn in this business is that, like, it's okay to say no sometimes, especially early on in a career, where it's like, if you don't say no, will you ever get those opportunities again? But sometimes no is the only answer.
That is exactly it. I think you nailed it. Like, the fear, the scarcity mindset of an actor, really anyone who's self-employed, crew as well. I talk about this all the time with them, but it's like, you got to just keep working, because you never know when you're going to get your next job. And what if I never work again? If I start saying no to things, I'm not going to get hired anymore. And that's terrifying. And it's really hard to know your worth and say, actually, no, I don't want to do that job, because I want to do this instead. And I don't know. It's hard for anyone that's self-employed. It's hard for women. It's just difficult to navigate in this industry sometimes.
It is. I feel like you have found the right people to surround yourself with and the right projects to walk into.
I got real lucky.
I feel like this industry and like the people watching your stuff are like very much understanding your value in this space right now. And I think that is true big time with the Yellow Jackets fan community. You knew I was going there.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's my way into it. I do feel like everybody was very, very sad when Jackie didn't really make it through. Everyone was theorizing, like, how's she going to come back? She's not really dead, right? She's dead. I do know that that was told to you early on when you first signed on, but I know that you kind of wanted to stay. So in those conversations, was there ever a moment where you thought, like, maybe, just maybe, they were going to keep you alive for the next season?
I definitely had hope. I don't know. It might have been false hope. I don't know. I was prepared. You know, I knew from the get-go, I knew from the pilot that was Jackie's ending. And I really was committed to the bit. And then somewhere around episode 5 and 6, it really hit me. Like, I wasn't going to work with these people again. And I was so sad. You know, mostly it was the cast and the crew and the writing. And I really did like Jackie by that point. And so I did... hope that they would find a way to keep me on. They entertained the idea for a little bit, but they ultimately called me and they were like,
"We're
sorry, Jackie's gotta go." And, you know, watching it, it's good TV.
It is. It's very good TV. And the silver lining is, if you can't work with those actors on Yellow Jackets, that just means you have to do more projects and cross paths on future things.
Exactly.
Okay. Theory questions. Had Jackie not frozen to death, do you think she eventually would have forgiven Shauna, or would that have been completely off the table?
I think she would have. It depends on your definition of forgive. Hmm. I think that she would have forgiven her, but it would have taken years and years and years to work through that resentment. And I'm not sure the wilderness is the best place to work through resentment. Like we've talked about, when you're in a sort of adrenalized state of fight or flight, it's hard to have the brain space to process deep emotions. And maybe some stuff would have come out. Okay. It maybe would have gotten a little spicy.
Fair enough. I feel like all these questions are formatted. Had Jackie not frozen to death? Had Jackie not frozen to death? Do you think she would have had any chance of surviving the wilderness, or would something have eventually got her anyway?
To be honest, I think something would have gotten her anyway. But I think it's a mentality thing. I think that when she discovered the betrayal, I think part of her gave up. I think part of her just could not, you know, she tried to change her mind about everything. She really knew who she was going to be. And then that whole thing got challenged and she tried to bend and she just couldn't, and she broke. And I think so part of her just gave up, and I think something else would have got her.
Yeah, probably. Because you just emphasized that she really knew who she wanted to be. What if she did survive and got out? How might her adult life look different than what she had originally envisioned?
I think she would have moved to New York and had an amazing wardrobe and maybe worked in fashion or journalism or been some fancy businesswoman. Maybe not journalism, that would be more Shauna's thing. But something creative and glamorous where she got to like really live her Jackie life.
So I'm sure you all have done this, but I go down the Reddit rabbit hole all the time. And I read something on Reddit where they were theorizing about what Jackie's life would have been. And someone had suggested that, like, Shauna essentially took Jackie's adult life. So I feel like journalism might be appropriate.
Maybe.
And it would have been a situation where they flip-flop.
Yeah. Well, equally, it's interesting to think of what Shauna would have done had Jackie survived. Mm. How different both of their lives would have been.
It's a sign of such good TV. I can think about this all day long.
This is a Yellow Jackets affliction.
It's a problem. It's a problem. To tie into something you brought up earlier in the conversation about, like, characters sticking with you and, like, maybe repeating okie dokie, is there any specific, like, scene of Jackie's that, I don't know, has, like, a special place in your heart or even a quality of hers that you've kind of held tight to?
That's a good question. My favorite scene to film for Yellow Jackets was the fight that Jackie and Shauna have in the finale, because, oh God, it like will give me goosebumps. The rehearsal, the first time we did it, and Sophie, like the first time Sophie actually brought it, the first time she actually turned it on, because we're kind of lazy actors. We won't do 100% in the rehearsal, neither of us will. But the first time she turned it on, and it was like, whoa, because I had never seen Shauna that way. And the power balance, we had no idea what was going to happen. And it just went whoosh. so fast, and it was shocking, like flooring. And that is like such a special moment. I don't know. It was really special.
I'll leave the Yellow Jackets talk there, but just because I need to speak this into existence, one day Sophie needs to get an Emmy nomination
for her
work on the
show. Oh my gosh, she was robbed.
The fact that she didn't get it for
her performance
two
in the finale.
Oh,
season two, that episode six.
Woohoo.
She's an incredible actress, mm-hmm. and she downplays it. She's amazing.
I've said this to her face. Yeah. She's like, no.
Oh, it's ridiculous. I can't even with her. She's incredible.
The time will come.
It will.
Here's how I'm going to teeter into Fallout now. It's one of my favorite lines and ideas in the show, and I'll apply it to your career in a broader sense. Will you still want the same things when you have become a different animal altogether? So first part of this question, what is something that you thought was important to you as an actor building a career in Hollywood that you eventually came to realize was not a priority anymore?
Being liked. And that's probably something that most women have to reckon with at some point in their lives, is just letting go of the conditioned need to be liked and be likable, right? Because you know people don't like you, but you just have to always appear likable. And I think it's with social media, I sound like an old person, but with social media and everything like that, you know, it's so hard not to read the comments, and it's so hard to not care what the critics say about your work, because as entertainers, it's easy to believe that's your job. Right, is to make stuff that people like. Mm-hmm. It's not your job to make stuff people like. It's your job to make stuff. Whether they like it or they don't like it, it doesn't matter to you. You're done with your job. And it's freeing, actually, to come to that conclusion. And maybe Yellow Jackets, in a way, helped with that, because it was my first time playing a character that I honestly thought wasn't likable and people wouldn't like. And I had a real fear, like, is anyone going to care when Jackie dies? Because she's such a piece of work sometimes. But, you know, she turned out to be a fan favorite, and it was really like, I really get to do whatever I want. And now I want to play a villain. I want to play someone really evil. I want to go there, you know?
Oh, I believe you can do it. I like that. All right, here's my other half of that particular idea. What is a new goal or ambition that you've picked up that, you know, you first starting out in this business would never realize would become a dream? I guess maybe the villain thing could answer that, though, now that I just said that.
The villain thing, you know, this might be a cheesy answer, but I think redefining contentment. I was asked the other day, do you feel like you've made it? And it was a really thought-provoking question, because I don't, what is it? Made what? Mm-hmm. And I think it's a personal definition of, some people might believe that that's winning an Oscar. Everybody has different goals. I think for me, my life has been so crazy, and there's been a lack of stability. It's like this all the time, and you have to redefine what contentment, happiness looks like for you. And I think when I was younger, I thought of that as career success, and now I think of it as balance. Of course I want to be successful, but successful to me isn't being rich or famous or having awards. It's doing work that I feel proud of and doing work that challenges me. And if I can find a way to do that and balance it with having a family and friends and richness in my life that isn't just my work, that's contentment. It's really hard. I'll let you know when I figured it out.
Yeah, really. But and I feel like it's something that, like, you think you figure it out, and there's still more learning to go with
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I think that's, I'm learning that I'm always learning, and it's going to continue to evolve. And maybe my definition will change. Maybe in a year I'll just be vying for an Oscar, and it's all I'm going to care about.
When you come back on Ladies' Night, we'll revisit this question,
yes,
and
can
we'll pave the way.
Let's do that.
All right, so digging into Lucy now, this is one of my favorite character questions to ask. When you first signed on for Fallout, what quality of hers were you most looking forward to playing? But then can you also tell me a quality you found along the way that wound up being more creatively fulfilling than you could have imagined?
Yeah. Oh, God, these questions are so good. The thing I was excited for was the comedy. I haven't done any comedy stuff, I think, in my career. And she's naturally funny. And I was nervous because trying to be funny, you're never funny. It's hard to sort of force it. I guess Jackie has some comedic moments, but none of that was intentional. It was all in the editing, I promise. So with this, it was more about actually just doing less and letting the writing speak for itself. You know, so much of it is editing and music and the tone and all the stuff you're not seeing that's happening behind you off camera, all of that. So I was really excited to do that. And I guess one of the things I found along the way was don't try to be funny. Actually, then it just feels forced and it wouldn't work. And the scene got strangled because you're kind of waiting for the punchline. You know, you're giving it too much. You're patronizing the audience. And I think I found like, just pull it back and just stick to her four cornerstones, you know, stick to playing an authentic character and it will write itself. The scene will play itself. You know, the show, take a character that has lived underground her entire life. She has really no trauma or suffering, you know, or hardship. It's not the way that people who have lived on the wasteland have experienced. And you put her in this irradiated, bonkers, satirical, comedic, dark, devastating wasteland. You don't need to do anything. Do less.
You are really pitch perfect in that respect. Like that was one, there's many things that wow me about this show. That was one of the first things that caught my eye and ear, I guess, was just like how spot on a lot of that delivery is. So job very well done in that respect. I have a couple of like more theory type questions. So she's lived in the vault her whole life. What do you think she dreams of becoming when she grows up in the vault? Does she maybe want to follow in her father's footsteps and be an overseer?
Maybe that's a good question. Yeah, I actually don't. I think she would have made a fantastic overseer, but I do think I don't think she dared to dream because of the burden of obligation. She embraces that obligation and that duty in a very positive, okey-dokey way, that obligation and duty of procreating, of creating the next generation of vault dwellers who will go to the surface and rebuild America. She is so committed to that cause. She loves kids. She's a teacher. She'll continue to be a teacher. She'll be a wonderful wife and a wonderful mother. And that's what she wants to do. Now, you see these glimpses where she questions, is that it? Is that it for me? She might have deep dreams of being the overseer. But I also don't think she thinks that her dad will ever not be the overseer. He's the overseer, you know, and she's doing her duty. So, yeah.
I'm not going to forget not daring to dream because of the obligation. Like that's going to burrow its way into my brain now. And
scary.
I'm gonna be thinking about that all day long. Another theory question for you. What do you think Lucy's life would be like if she lived like where we are in modern day 2024?
Ooh, I think number one, she wouldn't be Lucy unless she had come from the vault. Maybe if she was Lucy, she'd lived in the vault and then come up to today's 21st century modern New York. Oh
like
my
I'm picturing
gosh.
Like
why is that so funny? Like I'm picturing Lucy just trying to navigate New York and just... Kind of similar.
I picture it like Barbie, like coming from like isolated Barbie land where everything operates a particular way and then arriving in the real world.
That's great. You know, someone described this show as Barbenheimer, the TV show.
Oh,
and I thought that was insane. And I can't stop thinking about it. But Barbie is so right. It would be that. I think she'd probably end up doing some like charity work. She'd be a philanthropist. Charity, happy,
that.
Good person. She's a good person.
I like the golden rule.
Yeah.
I wish everybody abided by the golden rule.
Right? The world would be a better place, or would it?
Every time I think that, I'm like, I've only seen half the season. I don't know what's coming. For this question, if you need to teeter into like 4-episode spoiler territory, I can lift the spoiler warning for everybody. When do you think is the very first time that Lucy doubts the golden rule and the vault mentality in the show?
It's a good question. It's good. Lucy meets the ghoul at some point in the show, as I'm sure people have pieced together. And they are very different. Obviously, Lucy truly, truly believes that she is good and everyone should be good. And then there's the ghoul, who is a survivor, and he's had to adapt because he's been on the wasteland a long time. And he really puts her through it. And I think this is the first time she has ever struggled this much in this way. Perhaps her first experience ever you know, with trauma, with pain, with suffering, to that degree at least. And there becomes a point when you reach sort of the end of, really, you explore the extent, the depths of what humans are capable of, how much you can tolerate, how much you can take. And I think she gets to the end of that rope. And I think that's the first time that she experiences rage. And it's the first time she experiences like true hatred and anger. And that's an emotion that terrifies her. She didn't know that she was capable of that. That's what I love. That's thing that was so exciting to me. What do you do with that?
It's so full in episodes 1 through 4. So knowing what lies ahead in that respect, there's one scene, I think it's in episode 2, that also catches my eye, where she has the conversation with Majun and she explains like their perception of vault dwellers. Yeah. And you have like a dialogue-less moment where you could just see the wheels in your head turning. And I'm like, oh,
yeah,
like I see the crack. Yeah. I see the first crack.
That was a really fun scene because we did so many different things. And one of the best notes that Jonah ever gave me was, when you're saying this line about how vault dwellers are going to rebuild America, just look around you. And I did it. And then there was this like shame that sort of started to creep up, because as she's saying it, she realizes what she's saying. Like, what does she sound like? And it's kind of like she's repeating this corporate lingo that has been drilled into her from Vault Tech, you know, handbooks for centuries and centuries. And as she's saying it, she realizes how privileged it sounds and self-righteous, and that, you know, these people don't need saving. America has rebuilt itself without them. You know, there's all of these realizations. It's the first time her worldview is challenged in that way. And it can be, I imagine, for Lucy, quite destabilizing.
Oh, what an effective, I feel like that's like the exact moment I'm referencing to. Yeah. It's so powerful. It's so full. I wanted to talk about the dynamic between Lucy and Norm too. Did you and Moises ever talk about maybe things from their past that would put them on such different paths in terms of how they contribute to vault life?
That's a really good question. We did, honestly, most of what we talked about was trying to guess the plot and where it was going to go and try to figure out what's going on with our parents. What's the story about? Where's and most of Norm's storyline, you know, episodes 3 and 4, you know, I'd be texting Moises all the time, being like, you know anything yet? Just let me know. Because we didn't know anything. You know, we find out when we read the scripts.
I feel like that's probably, it makes it a little more effective.
Yeah,
when you can go in definitely not knowing and play not knowing.
Yeah.
Who on this set is the person who had all the answers?
Geneva and Graham had all the answers, the writers, but they wouldn't share them.
Yeah, yeah.
They wouldn't share the answers. They would sometimes, you know what's really funny? Sometimes they would come to set during like a big scene or a big moment, and they would pull certain people aside and then talk to them in the corner, kind of like with hushed tones. And you knew they were like revealing some plot points. And you'd just be like trying to listen in. And then they'd come back and like, you know, the cast member would sit down like all knowing. They look at you and you'd be like, tell me, what did they say? And they're like sworn to secrecy and they could never tell you. And it's like, that's part of the fun. It's so fun not knowing. I like surprises. I tried to spoil them, but I do like surprises.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I'm obsessed with like lore and backstory. I don't know if you do this kind of work, but is there any specific thing about Lucy's past that like you developed on your own? We don't necessarily see or hear about it in the Finnish show, but we can maybe feel it informing your performances and the choices she makes along the way.
Good question. I love research. It's probably my second favorite thing. When you asked me that question earlier, I was going to say research. I will make playlists. I will imagine, you know, what they like to wear, what kind of perfume they would wear, you know, all of these, you know, annoying, pretentious actory things, but I kind of love them, even if they're completely useless. I guess that was playing the game for me. Jonah and Geneva and Graham, they all told me, you don't have to play the game. You really don't need to. It's not, you know, mandatory by any means. And I did anyway, because I wanted to feel the full weight of what all of this meant. I wanted to feel that the gravitas of that moment when I first tried on the vault suit and knowing like,
how special this was and what a big deal, what an honor it was to be able to do that. And I think one of the examples I can give is one of the themes of the game is choices. Mm-hmm. You know, the choices that you make change your character's trajectory. And leveling up weapons is another big thing. And so there's this moment where Lucy, the pacifist, who only ever uses a trank gun, is given the decision, is she going to level up her weapon? And it wasn't really a big scripted beat. It wasn't a big scripted moment. But for me, the context of knowing this is something from the game that could be a really big deal allowed like just a little extra second of thought, a little extra second of hesitation, of like temptation. You know, what does this choice, how is this choice right here going to affect my future? Who knows if it's going to make a better performance or not, but it sure is fun.
Oh, I love that. I feel like you can see and feel thought like that behind a performance. And I see that kind of stuff radiating off the screen from like every department in this show. Good. I have to wind down with you. I'm ending with my new favorite question. I always have to warn people, nobody likes this question, but I think it's an important thing to talk about because in this business, we give awards to each other and that's super cool. Nobody says good job to themselves nearly enough.
Aww.
I want you to tell me something you do in Fallout that you'll be able to look back on and say, I am so proud of what I did there.
Oh, that's such a lovely thing. How nice is that? I'm proud of my stunt work because I am a clumsy, uncoordinated, not fit person, or I was. And, you know, I did break a few props, but I didn't hurt anyone and I didn't hurt myself. And I stretched and I warmed up and I got fit and I quit smoking. And, you know, that's not something I ever thought I could do. So I'm proud.
So much to be proud of right there.
That was so nice.
I'm going to say thank you for your time. Thank you for joining me for Ladies Night. Congratulations on everything you've accomplished on Fallout and everything coming your way in the future. The Ladies Night door is open to you whenever you want to return.
Aw, thank you so much. And thank you for the thoughtful questions. It's been such a great conversation.